Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Tonight we're starting in Exodus 17, so grab a Bible. Most of tonight we're going to talk about Moses and water from a rock and the consequences of Moses' interaction with that rock. And then we'll make it all the way to where we had tried to get last week, and we'll get into 1 Corinthians 10 and let Paul tell us that these things that we've been looking at the last 2 weeks were written for our example. So they were written for us to learn from, because last week we saw Moses create a pattern in his writing, and it was obviously much more than just a narrative device that he was using. He laid out a series of events that seemed to fall into, didn't seem to, a series of events that actually fell into a pattern where God would lead the children of Israel into a place where the problem was. And then they would confront the problem and whine and moan and complain, and then God would deliver them from the problem. And then he would add a rule. And then he would take them to the next place where a problem was. And they would confront the problem, and they would whine and complain and be upset, and then God would deliver them from the problem, and then they had a rule. God has already given them food when they complained about food. They complained about how they used to eat meat to the full and had bread to eat when they were in Egypt, and so God gives them bread from heaven and brings in quail for them to eat. And proves, look, I can do bread, I can do meat. That's not really what the problem is here. He takes them to a place of bitter water. They complain. He shows them the cure. And every time that he does it, he gives them a new rule. Obey me, do things my way, and I'll bless you, and I'll keep you from all the sicknesses that I put on Egypt. And then when the bread comes, he says, gather it for 6 days, and on the seventh day rest, and don't go gather it. And as we saw last week, no sooner does the rule go out that says don't gather on the seventh day, then Moses also includes that people went out on the seventh day and went trying to gather, and God naturally grows weary of these people's disobedience. And yet, with each new event that he takes them to, one word kept showing up. Remember what word it was every time? Test. The word test kept coming up. God kept saying, I'm going to give them a rule because I'm going to test them. And then he said, I'm going to take them into an area because I'm going to test them. And I'm going to deliver them because I'm going to test them. And he just kept bringing that word up over and over. I'm doing this to test them, to put them in a circumstance to see whether they've learned yet to trust me. And as I said last week, if there was ever a group of people who had every obvious reason to trust, these folks did. Having been delivered through the Red Sea, you would think would be sufficient to get them to say, well, clearly God is here, and he's clearly for us. You would think that when he drowned the Egyptians, that would have been good enough. You would think that when he made all of Egypt dark, but left Goshen in the light, you would have thought that that would have been sufficient. These folks have seen the pillar of cloud during the day, the pillar of fire by night leading them. That should have been sufficient. I would think that the miraculous bread from heaven every single day when you get up, good enough reason to trust God and say, you know, he really is taking care of us. And yet these folks simply do not, will not trust and believe. Leading me to ask the question last week, why? Why would these people not trust and believe? They have every proof, more than adequate inducement, plenty of physical evidence that God is there and he's for them. And yet, they fail every test. Why don't they believe?
They can't.
Because they can't. Because if they could, they would. They sure would. Who wouldn't under these circumstances? Under these circumstances, of course they would believe. They have every good reason to believe, and yet they don't. And I think that speaks loudly to the human condition. So we're going to see more of that tonight. We're also going to see Moses. We're going to get a little bit better personality profile of Moses tonight. And throughout the Bible, whenever you do get a personality profile of somebody, it's really reassuring because virtually never are they like great and perfect and wonderful and faithful and doing the right thing, and nobody's scoring 100. And when you read about Peter in the New Testament, you get a very complete, or at least the most complete personality profile of any of the apostles. And what do we find out about him? Always saying the wrong thing, sticking his foot in his mouth. I'll never forsake you. I'll never leave you. Yeah, well, before the cock crows, you're going to deny me three times. The consistent personality of Peter, or the consistent personality of Thomas. Every time you see him, he's going, well, I don't know what you're talking about. Jesus says, I'm going to leave, and where I go, you can't go, but the way you know. And he goes, where are you going? We don't know where you're going. We don't know the way. It's always Thomas. I won't believe unless I get a chance to stick my finger in the nail prints. I won't believe. It's always Thomas saying this kind of stuff. So in the Old Testament, we get this personality profile of Moses. And despite the fact that he is called the meekest of men, what we do know about him is that he is by nature a pretty rough character and has a temper. And that temper gets the best of him over and over again. And why did he get thrown out of Egypt? Why was he on the run and end up on the backside of nowhere and run into Jethro and end up married to Zipporah and spend 40 years in the wilderness? You remember what he did that got him tossed out of Egypt, though he was a prince?
He killed somebody,
yeah.
Out of anger.
Couldn't control himself, killed a guy. Tonight, we're going to see Moses, in a fit of anger, do something that is going to mess up a typology that God has been very carefully constructing. And his humanity and his temper is going to get the best of him, and he's going to lose the opportunity to go into the promised land because of his temper getting the best of him. Well, that's good for me to know. Not good for me to know that he lost the promised land, because even God entered into that circumstance and ended up using Joshua to take them into the promised land, a great type of the fact that the law can't get you into God's promises. But Joshua, who has the same name as Jesus, Jesus is the Greek cognate of Joshua, the Hebrew name. So it's interesting that Joshua would lead them into the promise where the law couldn't. So God entered into even these circumstances and ended up teaching the same truth over and over again. But I am reassured every time I read these stories of people in the Bible and see them fail and see them goof up and see their personality get the best of them, even though in Moses' case he's already been chosen and working powerful miracles and delivering God's people, and he's still going to really blow it. Very much like David. David gets to be king, and he's been told ever since he was a young boy that he was going to be king, and yet even though he's ruling over Israel in his splendor, he can't help but go up on the top of his palace and look at a woman bathing and say, I'll have her. So you see these personalities in the Bible. All I'm getting at is you see these personalities in the Bible, and they're just people. Folks like you and me. Folks who are prone to making big mistakes. And the great news is, never once do you ever see God react to them according to what they deserve and say, okay, then you're not mine anymore. Even though they blow it big time in tremendous ways, Moses is not going to get the promised land because he is going to destroy the typology of Christ. And God is going to say, that's it, you don't get to go into the promised land. Yet, when Christ is walking on the planet and he's on the Mount of Transfiguration, who shows up?
Moses
and Elijah. Is Moses still in the mind and will of God? Sure. Is Moses standing right there next to Christ? Sure. But did he blow it? And did God give him the consequences of the fact that he blew it? Sure, yes. That's the way God works. But he never casts his people off for their mistakes. But he's willing to correct you for your mistakes. So, chapter 17, verse 1 starts, then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Now look at how Moses constructed this scenario. The sons of Israel journeyed out by stages according to the command of the Lord. In other words, God was specifically commanding the people to go to Rephidim, where, by the way, there was no water. Do you think God knew there was no water at Rephidim?
Yes.
You think this was a surprise to God?
Nope.
I did what?
Oops.
Don't. I mean, there's no way that God did not plan this. And Moses writes it as if God planned it and says, they traveled by the command of the Lord to Rephidim where there was no water for the people to drink. God's very purposefully doing the same thing. Same pattern. Take the people to the problem. Let them encounter the problem. See how they handle the problem. Then deliver them from the problem. So verse 2 says, therefore the people, here's how they handled the problem. The people quarreled with Moses. Same consistent pattern. Always upset, always angry. So they quarreled with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. Which is almost funny, because Moses is a guy who's also with them in the middle of the no water. And they quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. Clearly they knew he was going to be the contact of God, and in the past we've gotten birds, in the past we've gotten bread from heaven, and whenever we ask Moses, he goes to God, and we get stuff. So let's yell at Moses like it's his fault. And Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me, and why do you, what's the next word?
Test.
Test, there's that word again. Why do you test the Lord? Why do you try the Lord? Why are you tempting the Lord? After everything he's done for you, do you really think that he brought you to this place of no water and now is just sitting back going, well, that's the way that turned out? He says your constant quarreling, your constant complaining, your constant unhappiness is just another way of saying to God, clearly, God, you don't know what you're doing. You've brought us here, but don't you realize that you've brought me into another problem? What are you doing, God? Anybody here whined at all this week about anything? Now listen, here's a principle. Hold on to this principle. If God is sovereign, and we keep saying that's true, we keep saying that God is sovereign, that means he's in charge. That means that he knows what's happening, and he knows why it's happening. And if that's true, then wherever you are at any given point in your life, and whatever you're going through at any point in your life, has a reason, has a purpose, and it's what he brought you to. If he takes you to Rephidim where there's no water, he knows that. And so you have two options. You go to him and say, God, you know. God, you know my situation, you know I'm thirsty, you know there's no water, and you know, the same way that I know, that you're either going to deliver me or I'm going to die. Or you whine and complain and moan and, oh God, what are you doing? And God, you don't know what you're doing. Listen to what these people say after everything God has done for them. The people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses, saying, why now have you brought us up out from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? As if that was the master plan. As if from the beginning the big plan was, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get these million people, and we're going to deliver them from Egypt during the night while the firstborn of Egypt are dying, until Pharaoh lets them go. And then we're going to take them with a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire right up to the edge of the Red Sea. And then we're going to part the Red Sea, and they're going to walk over on dry land, and then we're going to drown the Egyptians. And then we're going to take them to a place where they're going to complain about food and water. We're going to give them quail and then miraculous bread from heaven. And then from there, we're going to take them out into the wilderness where there's no water and kill them with thirst. That's the master plan.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Yeah, exactly. What kind of thinking is that? After everything God has done for them, their conclusion is, Moses, why have you brought us out here to kill us? And listen, and our children, and our livestock, and we're all going to die of thirst. Why have you done this? No confidence in God at all. So Moses cried out to the Lord and said, what shall I do to these people? You know that Moses was really getting tired by now. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to these people? A little more, and they'll stone me." Now even Moses is saying, these people are so angry, God, what am I going to do to these people? What am I going to say? How am I going to answer these people? A little more of this trouble, they're going to kill me, because I've led them by your command to this place where there's no water. Now remember, I said that when God takes you to a place, to any place in your life, takes you through any circumstances in your life, there's purpose to it. Remember I just said that? God is now going to demonstrate what the purpose was. He brought these people to this place where there was no water on purpose so that he could teach the type of Christ. God was preparing to teach. And he knew the best way to get through to these people was going to be when they were in that extreme, we're going to die frame of mind. Then they were going to pay attention. If everything was good and they had plenty of food and they had plenty of water, it's going to be really hard to say, everybody, over here, I want to show you something. Everybody, I got something to teach you. Come here. They're going to go, no, we're good. We're eating quail. We're waiting on the bread. We're drinking right now. We're happy. We don't. But when you've got people right at the edge of their comfort level, when they're starting to feel the pain, when they're starting to have trouble in their life, that's when God gets their attention. Verse 5, then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile. Now, do you remember what happened when he struck the Nile River?
Blood.
Turned to blood. So this is that same staff that he's now going to take and strike a rock. The same way he struck the Nile and it turned to blood. Verse 6 says, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it so that the people may drink. We're in the middle of nowhere. There is no water. So now God is going to bring water from the most unlikely place. He's going to bring water out of not just a rock, but twice he says, the rock. Now that's really interesting language. Now he says that he does this at Horeb. Anybody remember Horeb? You've heard about Horeb earlier on in our Genesis study. What happened at Horeb? Why would Moses be familiar with Horeb?
Burning bush.
Moses went to the backside of nowhere and saw a burning bush. At Horeb. So this is territory, wilderness territory, that Moses has been in before. But it makes sense if you think about it. If Moses is in Egypt and has to flee, where's he going to flee to? And the Israelites now have left Egypt. Where are they? They're in that same wilderness. But it's the same place where Moses met the burning bush. And so now he says, at Horeb, take the elders and now strike the rock. Jewish archaeologists and historians connect the rock in this instance to Jacob's pillar stone, and here's why. If Jacob had laid his head on a rock and seen a ladder of angels ascending and descending, as we hear he did, and on that rock he heard the voice of God reaffirming the Abrahamic covenant to him, which we read is what happened in the book of Genesis, then he called that place Bethel, the house of God, that rock. Do you think that he then walked away and left it in the middle of nowhere and went back and told all his friends and family, God appeared to me at Bethel, the house of God? Would they have just ignored that and walked away? Or would they, in keeping with their long, rich history, would they have marked that stone, kept that stone, and taken it with them? Well, the Israelites have a long history of taking emblems with them. Soon we're going to read about the bronze serpent because God is going to smite the Israelites in one of their temper tantrums. He's going to smite them with poisonous snakes. And so they end up making a bronze serpent and putting it on a pole and saying, everybody who looks on that serpent will be healed. And then the Israelites carried that bronze serpent on a pole with them and started worshiping it. So they have this history of taking things, objects, and making them sacred objects and taking them with them. So there's a lot of speculation about how it is, why it is that Moses could be told, go to the rock and strike the rock. What rock? Unless everybody already knew what rock? Unless there already was the rock, which Paul is going to say in the New Testament, we'll go look at it in just a moment, that rock is Christ. He's going to use that exact language and say that in the wilderness they all ate of that spiritual bread and they drank of that spiritual drink out of a rock, and that rock is Christ. So now if Paul would say the rock that was struck was Christ, we have to understand this whole scenario and this whole rock striking thing as being typological of Christ. Let's just finish this brief little portion, then we'll go look at Paul, explain it to us. Behold, I'll stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he named the place Massah and Meribah because of their quarreling, the quarreling of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? After everything they've experienced, the essence of the way they tested God was that they said, okay, you've been with me so far. You've done everything for me so far. You've protected me so far. You have fed us. You've protected us. You've killed our enemies. But now there's this new problem. This is today's problem. And if you don't solve today's problem, I want to know whether you're here or not. He can take care of you for all of your life, and then you're going to bump into today's trouble, today's problem. And when you hit today's problem, that's the point at which you go, well, God, are you here or not? And he has this long, rich history of proving that he is there, that he's always been there, that he's been giving you life and breath and wisdom and clothes and food. And then today's trouble comes. So turn over to 1 Corinthians 10 for a moment, and let's see how Paul treats this. First Corinthians 10, we'll start at verse 1. Now, this is the theology that Paul draws from what we've been looking at for the last 2 weeks. And that makes my job really, really easy, because all I have to do is say the same thing Paul did, and I have correctly interpreted it. So that's really easy. Chapter 10, verse 1 starts, for I do not want you to be unaware. Some of your translations will say, I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and they all passed through the sea. That sounds familiar, right? We know what he's talking about now. The Israelites went through the Red Sea. They were under the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. Verse 2, and they were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Because they were under the sea and they were under the cloud. And in that way, he said they were baptized into Moses. Verse 3, and they all ate the same spiritual food. What's that a reference to?
Manna.
They all ate the food that came down from heaven, and they all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. So now Paul has told us that God created a type of Christ who was going to be smitten or struck, and then living water was going to flow out of him. So the typology is Israel was at the point of death or deliverance. And then God struck the rock, and they all lived because of the water that flowed from the rock. So that we would understand it when Christ came along and he was struck. And people who were dead in their trespasses and sins were going to live because of the living water that flowed from him. And that living water, of course, is the Spirit of God, the token of the new covenant, the infilling Spirit. So Paul says, they all drank from the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from the same spiritual rock. But look at the next couple words. The same spiritual rock which followed them. And that's another place in the New Testament where we get this idea, okay, this was not a random rock. This was a rock that they were carrying around with them. This is a rock that everywhere they went, some of them were carrying this rock, and wherever they went, the rock went with them. And that whatever this rock was, it was a known entity, a known rock that followed them. And then he tells them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, verse 5, despite everything Paul just said, they ate from the manna, they were baptized in Moses, they went through the Red Sea, they drank water from a rock. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. The proof that God was not pleased with them was that during the next 40 years, the entire first generation that came out of Egypt died in the wilderness, never got to see the promised land. Evidence, proof positive that God was not well pleased with them. So now, why was God displeased with them? Verse 6. Now, these things happened as examples for us, that we should not crave evil things as they also craved. So now Paul is saying, look, in God's great, big, grand, eternal purpose. Remember a couple weeks ago when we were reading in Ephesians, Paul saying that there were mysteries that had been hidden to former generations that were now being revealed through the apostles and the prophets, being revealed to the church, new information that previous generations didn't know. Here Paul's picking up that same idea and saying, generations of Israelites and 40 years of wilderness and all the writing about their temptations and their trials, Paul said, that was all written down for us. So that we would know the kind of God we're dealing with. And that we would know that we should not be torn away, taken away, or tempted by the stuff of life, chasing after the evil things. Now, one more thing. Was food a necessity for them?
Yes.
Sure, yeah, of course. Is food in and of itself a bad thing?
No.
Bad food. Twinkies are bad. But other than that...
Twinkies are not bad.
Twinkies are not bad. I'm sorry, we have a schism in the group. Twinkies not bad. Hostess cupcakes, good. Food in and of itself, not a bad thing. They needed water. Is water bad?
No.
No, of course not. They wanted water. They wanted deliverance from their enemies who were bearing down on them to kill them. Was that wrong to want that deliverance?
No.
No, of course not. Then how is it that Paul can say that they craved evil things? What did they crave that was so evil?
To return to Egypt.
They wanted to go back to Egypt and leeks and the garlics and the food and the meat, and we want to go back to the way we had it, and we want to worship our foreign gods, and later they're going to build a calf. And despite the fact that God kept giving them good things, they kept craving the stuff of the flesh. And they wouldn't trust God that he knew well enough to provide good things for them. Remember Jesus walking around saying, which of you, if your child came to you and said, I want bread, which of you would give him a stone? He said, and if you, being evil, know how to give good things to your children, how much more does your Father in heaven know how to give good things to his children? And yet every time God held back on some good thing, they immediately reverted to their flesh and whined and complained and argued and fussed and went to Moses and rejected and then got so deep into their flesh they said, you've brought us out here to kill us. We wish we could go back to Egypt. We want to go back to the way it was. We don't want this deliverance thing because we're not having our way. I want my way all the time. So he called them evil things. These things happen as examples for us that we should not crave evil things as they also craved. And verse 7, and do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and they stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord. There it is. We kept saying it's all about tests, testing, trying. He says, don't test the Lord. They did it. See, I'm a parent, and part of being a parent is trying to help my children avoid the mistakes I've already made. And I try to tell them, look, I already did that, and it didn't work. Therefore, I can save you a lot of trouble. Don't do it the way I did it, and you can avoid a lot of pain. Did they listen? No! See, all the parents are laughing. No, they don't listen. No, they got to go find out the hard way. This is exactly what Paul is saying. He's saying, listen, this was already written down. There's already a test case. There's already a group of people who God already did this with. And he delivered them, and he did miracles for them, he provided for them, and he took it. He did all that already, and they kept trying and testing him. Never happy, never content, continued to whine and grumble and complain against God. Now, we saw the way that turned out. He strew their bones in the wilderness. We know God doesn't take kindly to that, so smart people would take the example and not do it. That's what Paul's saying. He's saying they did the immorality thing, so don't. This was written for our example. They did the other gods and idols thing. That didn't work, so don't do it. They already did the sexual immorality thing. It didn't work. Don't do it. They already did the testing God, and it didn't work, so don't do it. And don't grumble, verse 10, and don't grumble, should I emphasize that one? And don't grumble, what does that mean? Don't complain, don't whine, don't go on about how bad you've got it, don't grumble. Pardon me? Oh, you want to circle that in big red letters? Oh, yeah. Tom would like to scratch that out of his Bible. He'd like to grumble as he does it. Don't grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. God turned them over to a destroying angel who came down and wiped out huge groups of them. You remember what happened to Korah and his band? You remember what happened to Korah?
Yeah, the ground opened up.
Yeah, the ground opened up and who got swallowed?
All of Korah's family,
Korah, his family, his relatives, the extended family, his animals, his tents, everything, into the ground, ground covers up, and God says, never talk about it again. Yeah. There, we're done with them. Why? Idolatry, complaining, not doing things God's way. That should be an example. Paul says, look, they've already tried the rebelling against God thing, and it didn't fly. Therefore, don't do it. Verse 11 then says, now, these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction. Well, then we need to be instructed by it. That's why we're doing this study in the book of Exodus. We're reading about how these people would not ever do things God's way and how God reacted. And God doesn't change. God still expects his people to pay attention to him and trust him. These things were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands pay attention, lest he fall. And this is the context in which we get to read 1 Corinthians 10:13. This wonderful verse that I memorized years and years ago, and yet as often as not quoted it completely out of context, but now he says, look, well, the word look isn't in there. I added that. That was added by Jim. Look, look. No temptation has ever taken you, but such as is common to man. Now, Paul is taking those Old Testament examples and the things we've been learning the last few weeks, and he's moving it into the New Testament and saying, whatever you're going through right now, whatever your trial is, whatever your test is, it's not unique to you. God has been trying and testing and protecting and dealing with people all the way back to what we've been reading in Exodus. He's been providing for his people and redeeming his people and delivering his people and then dealing with his whining people. He's been doing it for a very long time. And so Paul could say, now take the example, learn the lesson, because no temptation has taken you, no trial, no test has taken you, except what is already common to man. We like to think that we're the first one who ever suffered like this. Every 14-year-old girl thinks she's the first person who ever got her heart broke. I didn't mean 14 in specific toward you. But every heartbroken teenager thinks she's the first one that ever had her heart broken, and she thinks nobody has ever hurt the way she hurts. And the reason that your mother sympathizes with you? Because she hurt exactly the way you hurt at some point in her life. And she knows it hurts. But there's nothing you go through that people haven't gone through. See, once again, I went with the female example for the largely female crowd. There is no sickness that you've endured that is unlike the kind of sicknesses people endure. There's no human relationship and conflict you're dealing with that isn't common to the way humans have always conflicted with each other. There is no trial of your faith that you're undergoing that humans have not undergone. The trial of your Christian faith has been going on ever since Peter fled to save his own skin. The trial of your faith is a common Christian situation. There is no trial, no temptation taking you, but such as is common to man, but God is faithful. Don't you love the next phrase there? Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, that's the way it's always been. That's human history. We have proof of it. We've been reading the proof back in Exodus. There's nothing you're going through that others haven't already been through. Learn the lesson from them. They've already done it. Do it God's way. There's nothing you're going through that they haven't gone through. But whatever it is you're going through, God's faithful. Hasn't he been proving that all the way through Exodus so far? Despite their grumbling, did they still get bread from heaven?
Yes.
Despite their whining and complaining, did he still bring in the quail?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Despite their, oh, no, we're all going to die, did he open up the Red Sea? Sure, of course. Despite the fact that they said, oh, I see the plan. You brought us out here to kill us with thirst, and not just us. Us and our babies and our cattle. Boy, that's just cruel. Did God give them water from a rock anyway?
Yes.
Yes. Because the faithlessness of human beings in no way negates the faithfulness of God. Because God is true to himself. Paul, writing to Timothy, said, though we believe not, yet he remains faithful because he cannot deny himself. God is faithful to himself. And therefore, he is faithful to every promise he ever made to his people because his faithfulness is on trial there. If he does not do everything he said he was going to do in keeping his people, then he's not faithful. But, Paul said, when you're in the midst of your trial, your temptation, your struggle, remember this, remember God is faithful. And he was always faithful to the Israelites while they were faithless. He was faithful to them. How much more is he going to be faithful to you who are under the covenant of the blood of his son? How much more is he going to care about your struggle, knowing the price he already paid to purchase you? So he says, God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. Do you realize that that means that God knows how much you can take? And he knows what your breaking point is. And he won't tempt you beyond what you're able to endure. And just before you break, he will, with the temptation, provide a way of escape also that you may be able to endure it. So when the Israelites were right up against the edge of the Red Sea and the army was bearing down on them, did God provide a way of escape?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, a miraculous way of escape. How about this? How about we just go through the sea? Nobody expected that one. When they were at the point of we're thirsty and we're all going to die, did he provide the way of escape? Yeah, here's a rock full of water. A rock that'll provide enough water for 1 million people and their animals. When it came time for we're all hungry, we don't know what to do, we're going to go back to Egypt, we can't take it anymore. Did he provide bread from heaven every single day, specifically enough that every one of those people could have an omer to eat every day? Yes, that's exactly what he provided. So Paul's point is, if you know that history, and if you know that's the way God works, then when you are in your trial, when you're going through your struggle, when you're in your personal temptation, then you've got to know that God has not changed. He has always been this way. He is faithful. He does deliver his people. And if you know that, it gives you the strength to get through it. And that's why Paul said he'll give it to you that you'll be able to bear it, and he'll provide a way of escape that you can endure it. Because if you know the escape is there, it makes it easier to get through it. Because you know you're going to. You know you're going to be delivered. And that's what God kept waiting for. He kept waiting for them to go, we're thirsty, but God's going to deliver. We're hungry, but God's going to take care of us. He always has. He always will. God's going to take care of us. That's what he was waiting for. And they wouldn't do it. Hmm?
He was demonstrating that they wouldn't be like that.
Well, yes, he was demonstrating they wouldn't be like that. But you know what I mean in saying that's what he was waiting on. That's what the test was. That's what the test was every time, was to prove they wouldn't do that.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
I have so many times wished that God did not believe I could take quite so much.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that God wrote that Moses wrote, talking about the Israelites and their journey and the fact that their shoes weren't going to wear out, their clothes weren't going to wear out. He said, your shoes will be like iron and brass. And the second half of that verse is, and as thy day, so shall thy strength be. In other words, God knows what kind of day you're going to have and gives you enough strength to get through that day. And I feel that sometimes. I hit the bed at the end of some days and go, okay, that was exactly how much strength I had because I'm done.
Just barely.
Just barely, yeah. I heard a preacher once say that if that verse was true, that if you ever woke up one day feeling like you could take on the world, you know, like you could wrestle a tiger, you wake up with all that strength, go back to bed because you're going to have a tough day. If you need that much strength to get through your day, go back to bed. You know, I like the days when I wake up and I go, I'm going to have a really easy day. If this is how much strength I need, this day is a breeze. But yeah, I mean, he's measuring out the trial. He's measuring out how much you can endure. He's giving you the strength to get you through your day. Notice how much God takes credit for in every aspect of what it takes to get you through the next day, the next trial, the next circumstance. God takes credit for all of it.
Kind of along those same lines, there have been times, and I don't know, maybe this is just completely neurotic, but when I have prayed for certain things like patience, you know, there's a little part of the back of my mind that's like, okay, maybe I shouldn't pray for that because maybe he's going to give me something that I...
It's going to require patience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe I should be happy with the patience I have.
I should be thankful for the patience I've got. And thank you, God. I don't mean to be...
Really?
I don't mean to sound impatient, but I'm good. Yeah.
Okay. All right, so then it would be an example of in which we sound like we're going to die. Like, you know, maybe you're on the brink of bankruptcy or something.
Sure.
And you're saying, oh, God, you know, where
sure.
are you? Where are you? Don't you
let's,
love me?
Don't no,
love
let's, me? Let's, let's it, you don't have to be at the brink of I'm going to die. I'm talking about any circumstance in your life. Mm-hmm. We become so unhappy and discontent with it that you lash out at God.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Oh, yeah. No, right. No. Because we do it way too often. Rather than trust that God knows where we are, he knows our situation, he put us there on purpose, he has the deliverance in place, and rather than knowing that God has always, always, always this track record of delivering the Israelites, knowing that that's how he is, then when we're in our personal trial, we should be ready to expect deliverance faster than we say, God, what are you doing? Why me? Why this? Why am I going through this? Why is this happening? Trust God. It is a trust issue, as Laurel said, much more so than a performance issue. But...
Because if it was a performance issue, there's no way ever we would ever...
Exactly right.
...escape the test.
If it were a performance issue, then the Israelites failed every single time, but did God deliver them anyway?
Yes.
Yeah, because God is faithful.
Right.
And that's Paul's point. God is always going to be faithful. And knowing that, then when you're in the trial, you should know that the way of escape provided by God is coming. It is going to be there. He's going to provide it because he always does and he always has. Therefore, instead of complaining, trust. Have faith in the God who delivers.
Okay.
That's Paul's argument. Okay. Right? Otherwise, your bones get strewn through the wilderness, which I have felt that way before, too. The wilderness bone-strewing. With the temptation, God will provide a way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it. Therefore, verse 14, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. So in other words, don't worship any other God. There's only that God, and he's faithful. Worship him. And notice one more time that he puts it in the context of Israel already did the chase other gods thing. That didn't work. Therefore, flee from that. I speak to you as wise men. You judge what I say. All right, now, let's look at one more thing tonight. Turn over the book of Numbers in the Old Testament. I told you that Moses, after striking the rock and the water flowing out of it, was told to approach that rock again. Numbers chapter 20. We're in Exodus, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, fourth book in the Old Testament. Now remember before that they were at a place called Meribah, out of water. Chapter 20, verse 1, let's start there. Then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there, and she was buried there, and there was no water for the congregation. Why? They've already been there. Remember, we just read, they came out of the wilderness of Zin, and they come to Meribah, and there's no water. So now they're back at that same place. Do you think God knew when he brought them back that there was still no water there? Yeah. Last time they were there, what did God do? Water from a rock. So what should they expect this time? They should expect God's going to deliver them. After all, he did it before. There was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and against Aaron. And the people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, if only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Remember earlier when God killed all those thousands, it would have been better for us to die with them. Why have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die there? Isn't this the same argument again? And why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us to this wretched place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water here to drink. Then Moses and Aaron came in from the presence of the assembly to the doorway of the tent of meeting. In the interim, they've built the tent of meeting, the tabernacle in the wilderness. So time has passed here. And yet these people react the same way when they're brought to the same place and go through the same circumstances. And then the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation. Remember the first time they just took the elders? And what's the next word?
Speak.
And speak to the rock. The difference here is he was not told, go strike the rock. Because in order for the living water to flow from Christ, how many times did he have to be smitten?
Once.
Once. After he'd been smitten once, in order to receive blessing from him, what do you do?
Speak.
Speak to him. So you go speak to the rock. Notice again, it's the rock. Again, no question about which rock. So apparently they've been carrying the rock with them all this time. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. So all he has to do is get the congregation together and say, okay, quit your whining and complaining and watch this. And take the rock they've been carrying around through the wilderness with them, speak to it, and water is going to come out of it. But Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, because his temper's getting the better of him, because he's sick and tired of dealing with these rebels, Moses gets in his flesh and says, listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Shall we do it for you? Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock. And the word twice is in there. Some of your translations will say the second time. He struck the rock the second time with his rod, and the water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. God was so upset with Moses for not doing it God's way that when God said, speak to it, because the rock only has to be struck once, and then he struck it a second time, and God said, you don't get the promised land for that one, because he messed up the type. Did the children of Israel learn anything from the rock and the water after it had been struck a second time? Did they learn the right lesson? Was the proper teaching put in front of them at that point? No. And why did Moses blow it? Because he was just so angry. He just got in the flesh, just so tired of these people. He said, look, you want me to bring forth water? Here. And he struck the rock. Yes?
So the reason he didn't get to go into the promised land was because he hit the rock, not because of him smashing the Ten Commandments. For some reason, I always thought that that's why that he was never allowed to go with that generation.
We'll talk about that when we get there. There's a plan of God behind the breaking of the Ten Commandments. But no, God wasn't upset with that at all. In fact, remember what he did? He went up there and made another one.
Right, he just made him carve out the
next set. He made him carve out the next set.
Right.
Which is, again, wonderful typology, because the law that was cut out with God's hand and written with God's hand, that law was broken because of sin and idolatry. But the second law that was cut out with a man's hand and written with the fingers of God, a type of Christ, that law was kept in the Ark of the Covenant. Moses played right into God's hands, and the typology of Christ was kept perfectly intact in that instance. So that is not why he lost the promised land. He lost the promised land for this right here, striking the rock a second time. But then, like I said, God in his great sovereignty even entered into that, what any of us would admit was a mistake on Moses' part, and yet God entered into that and made sure that it was Joshua who led the children of Israel into the promises of God. The Abrahamic covenant was continuing to be fulfilled as a result of a man named Joshua. Like I said, that's the Hebrew version of the Greek word Jesus, because the law can't lead you into the promises of God, and Moses was the type of the law. And the law couldn't do it, but Joshua could. So God even entered into Moses' big mistake here and sovereignly taught the same thing yet again, yet again. Because we worship a really amazing teacher in God. He's constantly teaching the same thing over and over again. And what he's teaching is, he's faithful, and it's all going to be by grace. And so far, nobody in the Bible ever deserved the kindness they ever got from him. But he just keeps pouring out that grace. And always, as we saw here again, always in Christ. Always connecting Christ to it. The blessings of God always come to God's people through Christ. Got that? Any questions about all that?
One question on the rock at Horeb. Since they're taking the rock with them, when they speak of the rock at Horeb, that is not a rock at Horeb that the Israelites go through the Red Sea for and go to Horeb where they find the rock and do their business.
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that.
Well, they would have probably carried it with them into Egypt when life was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And
you would think if it was that important an artifact that, yes, when they went into Egypt, they would have taken it. Remember, when they left Egypt, they took Joseph's bones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're known to carry artifacts and stuff with them.
I'm just picturing carrying this rock through Egypt, through the desert.
It depends how big you think the rock is. Don't forget how big the Tent of Meeting and the Ark of the Covenant and the Laver of Cleansing. Remember how big those things all are, and they end up having to carry them with them.
But still thinking if they had to go back, if they had to go to that place each time they're talking about the rock, they had to go there to get to see the rock. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but they already said the rock that followed them. That's how Paul described it.
Just the place that
but
didn't
could
have
that mean
water.
Like the rock that followed them, like Christ came after them? The rock that followed?
You tell me.
I don't know.
I don't know either. It's very sketchy information. It's admittedly very sketchy stuff. What we know for sure is what the typology is involved, and we know there was a rock, and that it was always referred to as the rock, you know, like a specific rock. And that's why historians and archaeologists and stuff speculate, okay, what rock would that be?
And while I think it's an interesting question and interesting speculation, I don't think it matters whether they say.
In the end, what we know is that it typified Christ.
Yes.
And in the end, we know that it's why Moses lost the promised land. So, yes?
Well, in waiting, I forgot what I was going to say.
Are you 52 too?
Yes.
I'm telling you, I do that all the time.
No, he has.
Yes, ma'am.
How long from the time that this occurred was it that the people went into Canaan?
I don't know. I'd have to do some serious calculating, because there was enough time between the two events that they had been to Sinai. They had gotten the instructions on the tabernacle. They had built the tabernacle. The very fact that they could say that Moses and Aaron went to the Tent of Meeting, the fact that Aaron goes with Moses this time means that Aaron's high priest now. So a lot of stuff has occurred that's going to take a couple years minimum, you know.
That shows Moses' faithfulness, though, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's been told, you don't get to go in, you blew it. Mm. So, but he continues anyway.
Right, and continues anyway.
Oh, yeah. He knows
who he's dealing with. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. After Korah's gone, you're like, you know, whatever you want. Yes?
I just remembered it.
Okay.
The sketchiness thing? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a test to see if we'll still believe it, even though it's pretty sketchy.
Could very well be.
That's profound.
That's profound.
I don't know what that means.
Profound?
Yes.
It's the opposite of pro-lost.
Don't know what that is.
Okay, never mind. Profound means deep and thoughtful. She thought that that was a deep, thoughtful question. So that was good.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.